Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy connecting the line. My guest today is Philip Smith, who has a new book called Walking Through Walls, and it is a true story of his father, who one day in the 60s suddenly discovered that he could talk to the dead and heal the sick, and he left over 5,000 pages of spirit dictation describing new and never-before-seen healing methods, and healed thousands of people in his lifetime. So tonight we have Philip Smith, and we will welcome him to the program.
Michael, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very pleased. I may say, having been a healer in my time, and in fact I still do it for family and friends, I've got more than a passing interest in the story you've got to tell us. Now, prior to the occasion when your father suddenly found that he could talk to the sick, did that mean that he never had any other psychic experience, that it suddenly just cut in like that one particular day?
Well, I think it's a little of both. I think it did absolutely happen one day, and I can describe that incident. But what's interesting, when I was researching the book, because my father left behind huge archives, there are examples. For example, I found a little tiny diary that he kept in 1925. He was 21 years old at the time. And in this diary, he would record his dreams. And the dreams were like he was visiting other planets, or alien beings were coming to talk to him. And, you know, there was no manga back then, or really not a lot of science fiction. We hadn't gone to the moon, and he was seeing all these things in his dreams. And he also kept records of all the books he was reading on, you know, the life of Buddha and Christian Science and Hinduism and all kinds of mystical books that back then in the 20s were very hard to come by. And basically, he would order these books from England, and they, you know, they would be used books. They would take 6 months to arrive by boat. But in this diary, there was one night he had a dream where he saw that there was a train wreck in the desert, and there was fire, and in the dream he heard children screaming. He turned the page of the diary, and the next morning he writes that woke up, went downstairs to get the paper, front page of the paper said that there had been a train wreck, I think in the Nevada desert, and 13 children were killed. So it's telling me that he's already becoming prescient back in the 20, when he's 21 years old. But the actual ability to heal took another 40-something years to formally manifest. What happened was he went to a lecture by a guy named Arthur Ford. Now, Arthur was a very famous medium who in the 20s would have sell-out kind of seances at Carnegie Hall. And he did readings for Gloria Swanson and the King of Greece. And he became very worldwide famous in the 20s because when Houdini died, he gave his widow a secret code, very complicated. It had numerals, numbers, words, and it all added up into a very specific sentence. And Houdini said to his wife, I don't necessarily believe in life after death, but I'm going to give you a secret code. If anybody comes to you with this code, you will know that I'm communicating to you. And she, the widow, had put out, I think it was a $10,000 reward at the time. And again, this is the 20s, which is a heck of a lot of money. And, you know, all these different clairvoyants and psychics applied. No one did it. But Arthur Ford delivered the code to her. And it was like in newspapers all over the world. So fast forward to like 1968, and Arthur's in Miami because that's where he was actually born. And he's giving a lecture, which actually my father taped, and it's actually in the book. And in this lecture, my father walks in, and it's packed, and he's looking for a seat. And a woman waves to him to come over, and my father thinks, oh, she's got an empty seat next to her. So he walks over, and she says, I see in your aura that you are a healer, and I'm very sick, and I need your energy. And he's thinking, you know, what's this about? So she said, please put your hands on my shoulders. So he did, and he felt his hands heat up like a toaster. And then after about 2-3 minutes, they started to cool down. He took his hands away, and she said, thank you. You know, the doctors told me I had cancer, and it's incurable, and I feel you've helped me. Thank you very much. So he went he walked away and went looking for another seat, and another woman waved him over, and he thinks, oh, finally a seat. Same thing. She says, you know, I have heart disease, and I see you're a healer. This then happened a third time where a woman waved him over, and he walked out of there basically a healer, and that was the beginning of his kind of very long career of becoming a healer and, you know, developing advanced healing methods, etc. It's a long answer to your question.
What was his name, incidentally?
Lou Smith, L-E-W.
L-E-W. I thought to myself that someone who has clearly been so successful and well-known at healing and in the spirit world, if you like, the world of interest, that his name would be quite well-known. But I must confess, it's not one that rings a bell with me.
Well, here, first of all, this happened back in the 50s and 60s, long before. People say to me all the time, I Googled your father, and I can't find him. Well, there was no Google when my father was alive. If you go to the website for the book, I mean, there were local newspaper articles about him written by the Miami Herald, and I put those on the website. It's walkingthroughwallsthebook.com. And I put those on there so that people could go and actually read these articles, because the Miami Herald, instead of digitizing their archives from 50 years ago, they shipped them all over to India to be digitized, and they were never properly digitized, so they're sort of lost. And so these examples I put on the website were for people to actually see these things. The other thing is that, unlike you say you are a healer, my father, back in the 50s and 60s, would get arrested if he walked into a hospital or for healing, and this is detailed in the book, because the doctors or the FDA came after him, the Medical Association came after him for, quote, practicing medicine without a license. There's a story in the book that I'm 16 years old, and, you know, I'm helping him out in the summer in his office, and we're driving home, and there's a car accident. And he pulls over to the side of the road to get out and help these people. And he leans over. There's three crash victims. And he's, you know, putting out his hands to try and heal them. And the cops come over and say, what the hell are you doing? And this is in a time when, in the 60s, when Miami was still segregated. There were bathrooms for men, women, and one for colored. If you were black and you walked on the sidewalk of Miami Beach after 5 o'clock and you did not have a letter or a permit from your employer, you were taken off the island in a police car. So imagine the times back then, the context, and here's my father trying to help this guy, and the cops pulled him off, and he brings over another cop. He says, I saw you, buddy. I saw you try and steal his watch. And my father, what are you talking about? And they arrested him, or he would go into a hospital, and the doctor would come in and say, who are you? And he says, well, you know, this is my friend's sister, and she has leukemia, and I'm trying to help her. And he would call security and get him kicked out of the hospital. So there's actually a reason why, first of all, there was no internet, there was not a lot of reporting on my father, and he had to keep a lot of his activities very secret at the time.
Yes. I must say, I wouldn't have thought it was that strict in what is comparatively a recent period of time. I mean, it's quite astonishing, really, isn't it, the attitude towards someone using a natural ability.
Well, my father's goal was really, because it wasn't just, you know, I know there's Reiki healers, but he went far beyond that. He was able to diagnose people very accurately with a pendulum, and people would come to him with a bag of medication that they were taking 10 pills. But they were very sick from the side effects, and he was able to take the pill. He had a little kind of magnetic sending board with some copper wires and magnets and a little copper coil. And he was able to distill from the medicine the essence, the healing essence in that pill, and send it to them psychically, and they would taste the pill in their mouth. But he was able to send it to them. So my father scared a lot of people, and there were doctors who basically, and also go back in time again, we're in the 60s. There's no CAT scans, there's no MRIs, there's no Lipitor, there's not a lot of these diabetic drugs. So if you got sick, the doctor basically took an x-ray, took a blood test, and said, sorry, you have congestive heart failure. There's nothing we can do. Go home. There was no catheterization back then to kind of open the heart with a balloon. Didn't exist. So the people my father saw were basically the outcasts of medicine that, that they couldn't be helped. So the, he would scare the doctors because he was able to heal these people, and they would go back. If they had liver failure, they would come to my father, and there's, again, a story in the book about that. But he would help them get better, and they'd go back, and the doctor said, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be dead. But there were certain doctors, there were very few doctors who basically believed what my father could do. And so given the fact that there were just a few blood tests and you know, some x-rays, they would call my father and say, listen, I've done the x-rays, I've done the blood tests, my patient's dying, I don't know what to do, tell me. But they would call him at night and they'd say, don't tell anybody I called you, because they were afraid that they would be, they would lose their license for basically dealing with a crazy person. So it was a very, very different time, and I think the ability that, for example, in New York, that Dr. Mehmet Oz has energy healers in the emergency room or in the operating room now, that's a miracle, and I wish my father was here physically to see that, and because he contributes to all that. And but he was a real pioneer, and let me tell you, he was treated like a dog in his lifetime because he was laughed at. We would get threatening phone calls. We would get the police at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, he also he never charged for this because he felt it was a gift. So we went from, he was an interior decorator and, you know, it was very glamorous. He had the president of Cuba. He had worked for Charlie Chaplin, for Dean Martin, the president of Haiti. I mean, my parents would go to Havana for the weekend. I mean, we led a Palm Beach. It was a very glamorous life. And then he finds he has this ability, and he eventually closes down his business and almost takes a vow of poverty. I mean, our standard of living declined very rapidly, but he felt that he was, he needed to do this, and he said, you know, what am I going to charge someone to save their life? $50, $5 million? What do I charge? I don't know what to charge, and he just didn't, and the spirits that he would communicate with on a daily basis, you know, told him, you cannot charge. This is a gift.
No, that, that's wonderful. I was going to ask you what effect his presence had upon the family, but what about yourself? How did it affect you?
It was very complicated because I knew that I could not talk about what my father did because I knew the authorities would come to the house. I mean, the most I did, and this will give you an example also of the times, when I was about 12 or 13, my father was studying yoga. He was actually teaching himself, and he did have a teacher. But again, this is 50 years ago. I mean, and I went to school, and I told my teacher that my father's doing yoga. And there was this pause, and she said, what's that? It's funny, but this is telling you how almost how we were certainly in the dark ages, and people don't realize how far we've come. For me personally, it was very difficult because I was a teenager and I was doing things teenagers do, which means doing a lot of things you shouldn't do. And my father, being psychic, knew when I was doing things I shouldn't be doing. So basically, it was like there was a, you know, a GPS system on my back at all times, or that there was a webcam attached to my head. I would come home having done things that were clearly not doable by a 16-year-old or an adult, and he would just sit down very quietly and said, you shouldn't be doing this, this is very dangerous, and, you know, I would hide things that I didn't want my father to find, and I'd bury them in the backyard, frankly, and the next day they'd be on his desk. So imagine growing up when you have no privacy, and as a result, I've grown up to be a very honest person because, you know, I don't know who's standing next to me who's reading my mind, so I figured I just better be honest. But it was very tough because it was kind of a schizophrenic childhood where, you know, he was doing seances and healings and talking to dead people at home, and then I'm going into this very conservative, you know, universe of going to school and the kids, and, you know, kids are interested in football and that's about it. Maybe they sneak a beer. And I can't tell my father, I can't tell them my father, you know, dissolved a tumor last night. You know, I can't do that. So I grew up with this very quiet public self, and then I would come home into this sort of very bizarre but fascinating universe.
Amazing. Do you believe that you came into that family, especially for the work you're doing?
You know, I never thought about this, but I recently was on a talk show. I think the woman's a numerologist, and she said, "You understand, of course, that there's a real reason why you were born to your parents, and there's an absolute reason why you are now." Because I'm a painter. I mean, I've it's all I've done for 30 years, and I've written this book, which I didn't even expect to get published. It was just something I was felt compelled to write the book.
Yes.
And she said, you know, you're actually have a responsibility to bring your father's work, you know, out into the world. It's time now that people know about this. And I said, you know, the reason I never wrote this book before is I'm still imprinted with the fear that someone's going to come and arrest me for knowing about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's how it was when I grew up. So she said, well, those times are over. I said, I know that, but so she said, now's the time to, you know, bring this out. And there's a very interesting story about the book. You know, I never told anybody about my father and, you know, very few people. And back in 2000, I had mentioned this to someone and they told an agent. The agent called me and we sat down, we talked a little bit. He said, well, I think you should write a book. And I worked basically 8 years on it because my father taped so many of his healings and his lectures, and there's thousands of hours of audio tapes, which was very time-consuming. And he would take the spirit dictation. Every morning he'd wake up, the spirits would wake him up, and he'd start writing. And it would be, maybe it was stuff about me, you know, Phil's not going to get into college, or, you know, here's how you treat your patient who has kidney disease. And so I read through these messages in writing the book, and it was about a week before I handed in the book, and I'm going through a folder. All of a sudden I found one more folder, and I thought, oh, boy, I've written the book already. I don't have time to add any more stuff, and I'm going through these messages. And there's a message by one of my father's spirit guides in 1971. It's telling him to please organize your papers, label everything, because Philip's going to write a book on you. Now, I had never seen this message before. So if that's not enough, a week later, I'm going to the airport, and, you know, there was one little bag of cassette tapes that I never listened to because they were never marked. They just didn't have labels. So I thought, you know, I'll listen to one of these on the way to the airport. And I took it, I popped it in the car, in the cassette deck. I'm going in the car. And in it, it's an English woman who's doing a reading for my father, also 1971. And at some point in the reading, she says, she's telling my father he might move and to look at land here. And she said, do you have a son? And he said, yes. She says, oh, good, because your son's going to be writing a documentary on you, and it's going to be about your work and your life, and make sure that you save everything from now on. Because now, he never mentioned this to me, and it was 71 to two. It's 30 years later that I start writing this book, and I thought, well, gee, this was my brilliant idea to write the book, when in fact, obviously, it sort of had to be done.
Yeah, well, it really confirms that the whole way along, you were meant to be where you were and doing what you're doing.
Yeah, it seems that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. Did your father go into mediumship at all?
Not really. What he would do, he used a pendulum for everything. And so, for example, if he would be talking to a spirit entity and the thoughts were coming into his mind, he might take out the pendulum as he was writing. Let's say he wrote down a sentence, you know, and sometimes the spirits would guide him to the back and say, go in the backyard, pick this flower, put it on your sending board because this is for the person with migraines. So he would write that sentence down and he would take out his pendulum and check whether this was his thought or was this one of the spirit's thoughts. So
yeah.
He would not really, if for example, he wouldn't channel your grandmother to talk to you.
Right.
So no, it was more, and his healing methods were very complex. I mean, he would, again, he got, as he progressed, the hands-on healing dropped away very quickly, and he was doing more, this kind of psychic transmission where he had these charts. They almost looked like celestial navigation charts, and he would take out these charts when someone would call him, let's say from California, and he would take out his pendulum and he would diagnose very quickly. They would just say, hi, you know, Barbara told me to call you. And he would then start to diagnose them with these charts. And there may be times, in fact, that, for example, let's say someone had breast cancer, and he would find out they had breast cancer, and he would with the pendulum in the charts, whether it was environmentally caused, whether it was drug-induced, was it psychologically induced. If it was psychologically induced, he had a list of about 100 different kind of mental states and attitudes, and he would go through it, and let's say he would find with the pendulum resentment or grief, and he'd say, okay, grief. And then he would ask the pendulum, well, is this grief because they were hit? No. Is this grief because someone died? Yes. And then he'd say, what is the date that someone died? And he would, March 22nd, 1943. So he'd say to the person on the phone, does March, you know, 1943 mean anything? And they say, yes, my daughter was killed in a car accident. And he said, well, this is the root cause of your breast cancer because you're holding on to the grief of your daughter, and we need to release that so you can, your body can start getting better and your cells can react, your, you know, immune cells can start reactivating. So
yeah.
He really didn't do mediumship, but he did communicate with spirits from beyond.
Right. I'm sure you must be familiar with Edgar Cayce's readings. Were your father's healing advice in any way similar to Edgar Cayce's? Because he always seemed to give out remedies that use quite commonplace things.
My father, you asked how all this came along. My father actually in the 60s read all the books about Edgar Cayce and was fascinated by him, and in the 70s became very good friends with Cayce's son, Hugh Lynn Cayce, who used to come at our house. Hugh Lynn, I met him once when I was a kid, but I found a lot of these entries in my father's diary, you know, Hugh Lynn coming, and it was usually during the winter. Cayce, as you know, would go into a trance and then, as you said, would recommend sassafras or castor oil, etc.
Yes.
My father, if the pendulum indicated that, you know, you needed to put oregano in your ear to heal the ear, yes, he would definitely do that. Or he may, the pendulum may indicate some, you know, drug, a pharmaceutical, so he would take out the PDR, the physician's desk reference, and say, what page is this drug on? Page 1043. So he'd look there, and is it this drug? Is it this? Oh, it's this drug. He would then psychically, I guess, analyze that drug, and then, how do I say this? He would build a thought form of that drug and then send that drug to the person, and he would determine the dosage with the pendulum. Do I send this one time a day, two times a day? And he would then psychically send this thought form to them until the drug, you know, took effect. So he admired Cayce. He was interested in Cayce, but he went in a very different direction than Cayce.
Right. What value do you think your father's healing methods have today? I mean, have things changed?
Have things changed for healers or for medicine?
Well, for his methods as opposed to what you have available today.
I think that my father, people ask me all the time at lectures, you know, is there someone you can recommend? And not that I just don't know a lot of healers, and I'm sure there's very good ones out there, but I think my father's methods were unique to him, and I said in the book that basically, you know, in many ways, you know, at the end of the book, I'm sort of fascinated and puzzled, and that this is my father. And I said, look, the best way to understand my father is he was simply, you know, 300 years ahead of his time. I don't see that anybody yet has done what he's done. I know he taught several people. And I did find some of his students who are still around, and they use his methods in a very benign way day to day, but not in the way that my father did. I think there's still I still think there's a lot to learn from my father, and I think that there's still I think he was this kind of brilliant genius, and we need to kind of unravel his work, and I think it's things that you know, I'm trying to sort of look back through his tapes and his archives. I think there's things we can still learn.
Right. I suppose it goes without saying that he used healing on his own family and yourself. Could you describe any type of healing you had and how you felt about it?
There's a story also in the book, but it's one of my favorites. When I was 17, I went to Europe with my girlfriend, and we had given my father an itinerary, a very specific itinerary. We're going to Iceland, Paris, Spain, Italy, Greece. She spoke Spanish, and when we landed in Iceland, we were, you know, it was a little bit of a culture shock. We're kids. This is, you know, and 1970 or something, and we've never been to Europe. And she said, you know what, why don't we change our plan and go to Spain? I speak the language. So I said, okay. So we went to Spain, and we checked into a little pension, and like within minutes, I just broke out in a sweat. I became incredibly ill. I became delirious. Mm-hmm. And I was thrashing around, and I was just making no sense. And she tried to get a doctor, and she was terrified. I just turned, you know, just white, and she was crying. And so she didn't know what to do. I mean, no one. It was a weekend. We were, you know, in the middle of nowhere as far as we were concerned. And back then, you know, the idea of calling the States would have been like a $200 phone call. Anyway. About a half hour later, all of a sudden I seemed to wake up, and I said, why am I all wet? And she just burst out. She said, oh, I thought you were going to die. And so anyway, I got up. I was perfectly fine, and we went about our trip. We were gone for about 3 months. When I got home, we landed, and I called my father, and I said, hi, Pop, I'm home. And the first words out of his mouth were, I'm really sorry what happened in Spain. And he said, what are you talking about? He said, well, you know, you left me an itinerary, and I was sort of psychically, you know, blessing you through the itinerary. I was lazy. And he said, I got woken up in the middle of the night by the spirits, and they told me something's wrong with you. And I was trying to connect with you because you were supposed to be in Paris, and I'm sending energy to Paris, but it's not, I could tell I wasn't connecting with you. I wasn't hooking up. And I didn't know what was wrong, so he had to get out an atlas and a map of Europe, and it took him about 15 minutes with the pendulum to kind of douse, you know, the continent and find that I was actually in Spain and zero in on me. And he said, you know, you were really sick, and he said, you almost had a horrible viral hepatitis, and he said, you know, I'm glad I got you in time. He says, next time please follow the itinerary you give me. And so how did I feel about it? I frankly was annoyed because I'm a kid. I want to show, oh, I'm independent. I can go to Europe by myself. I can take care of myself. But so he, and again, it was that idea that I was so well monitored by my father that it was hard for me to be, you know, grow up and be a little bit independent.
Right. Did he ever set up a healing clinic?
No, he wanted to. I mean, what basically our house was the clinic. And but, you know, again, if he were doing this today, because it's a little bit more mainstream, I think he would have had hours like 9 to 5. But people would come and bang on our door at 3 o'clock in the morning or call up screaming that their baby was sick. So it was like my father was like an emergency room physician. I mean, it was 24 hours a day, and it was very difficult on him and us because it was just, you know, first of all, it was something he was doing largely in secret because he was afraid of the authorities. And secondly, it was something not accepted by society, and he did not know he didn't have the ability to kind of organize it in a way. It was just like, you need me, I'm here. And I'm listening now actually to some of the tapes and these phone calls, and because he would take the phone calls to people, and he'd say, it would be the middle of the night. He says, if you need anything, call me back. It's like, I'm listening to this man. I say, Pop, tell him to call you in the morning. Don't, like, but he was just totally available.
Right, wonderful. When was there a stage, which I'm assuming took place, when he moved on, or in addition to speaking to people who had passed over, started to get spiritual teachers coming through?
he probably about the early 70s, like around 73 is when the messages seem to really kick in. And the first message, the first sort of spirit contact was Arthur Ford, the guy I talked about earlier, who broke the Houdini code, because he died. And once he died, he and my father became incredibly good friends, because he was like a nosy uncle that would, you know, call you 20 times a day. Arthur had a signal. When he wanted to talk to my father, he would blink the lights 3 times very rapidly. And in the book, I explain, there's actually a message from Arthur that I found. He explains that he found that the electrical current is at a certain vibration, and if he slows down his vibration, his entity vibration, he can interfere with that current, and he uses that, and the words were, as a calling card to signal my father that he's around. But we'd be in a restaurant, and we'd be having breakfast or lunch or dinner, and all of a sudden the lights would blink, and my father, oh, Arthur's here. And he'd take out a pen and start writing. And, you know, he'd be in mid-sentence explaining something to me, or I'd be saying something, and Arthur would, like, jump right in and, you know, start clarifying the conversation. So, but it was Arthur who eventually started bringing along a lot of his buddies. So he would basically, I guess he was kind of, you know, mentoring my father. So then he brought this guy, Chandra Sen, who became my father's master physician. He then brought Dr. Edward Bach, who I'm sure you're familiar with the flower remedies.
Yes,
and we
indeed.
Have messages from Dr. Bach. And he just kept bringing, and then there were a lot of, as time went on, these people didn't have, these entities, I should say, they didn't have regular names like Bob, John, Michael. They seemed to have more esoteric names, you know, Oversoul 7 or something. They became more and more ephemeral in a way, and the messages became more and more esoteric.
Right. Yes, you're mentioning Dr. Bach. When I was running my own groups in the 70s, I'm pretty certain I had his daughter as a talker at one of my meetings with an assistant. And of course, she wanted to talk about the way the Bach remedies were achieved. And it was a very interesting story, I recall. And I believe they're still freely obtainable now.
Yeah, they're now available in this country, but back in the 60s and 70s, my father ordered them from England. But he would not physically, as you know, they're like little homeopathic tablets.
Yes.
But he would not physically give, he never gave anything to anybody because he did, in the beginning, he would give someone some homeopathic tablets. And she, quote, got sick and called, registered a complaint with the Food and Drug Administration. They came in to, prosecute my father. So he stopped giving physical medication, but he would use the block system basically to analyze attitudes, because there were, you know, each one of these flowers dealt with a certain attitude, because Bach believes that, you know, it all came from mental distress and disharmony. And so my father had this list of attitudes. So he would, if he would find that someone was paranoid, he would then sort of look up the appropriate Bach flower remedy or use his pendulum, and then he would psychically send or ask the person to visualize this flower while he sent it to them, and that's how he treated them with the Bach flower remedies.
Very interesting. Describe some of what you have called the never-before-seen healing methods, assuming that they are still perhaps more peculiar to your father, not generally used.
In the book I mentioned some of them. It's interesting, there was when I and then I'll go into that, but when I went to get the book published, I wanted to have pictures in the book, and one of the toward the end of his life, my father had developed these two healing methods with guidance from the spirits that he called projectors. And one of them were these kind of like mandala-like drawings that are it's like nothing you've ever seen. They're these geometric drawings, and they're just on little index cards. But when you look at them, they emanate this energy. I mean, it's very tangible. You just look at it, it's like, woof. And I thought these would make, because they're beautiful, and I thought these would make great illustrations in the book. So I digitized them, and I'm getting ready to send them up to the publisher. And I found a folder and where there were more of them. And in the folder, there's a letter from, or a dictation from Chander Sen. And it's telling my father to be very careful and not really share these or show these to anybody because they are so powerful that they could attract dark forces and he could be harmed or someone else could be harmed because, the dark forces would want to stop this kind of energy. But what my father would do with these cards is that they were numbered and they had a vibratory rate attached to each one of them. It would say V5000, V150,000. And they had names, and it's the only thing I've not been able to thoroughly decode, really, in his protocols. And what he would do is that the spirits, he started using these not really to heal people, but to heal the planet. And let's say there was a hurricane coming, or there was a drought or something. The spirits would wake him up, and they would give him a list of numbers. And they would tell him, use number 16, number 37, 43, 82, and put them on the magnetic coil sending machine. But at 2 a.m. you need to change them, remove number 16 and add 47 instead. And he would do this. And when I was in Nepal many years ago and you go up to one of those stupas and they have the prayer flags and the prayers are sending up, the flags are sending prayers to heaven, I sort of likened it a little bit to what my father was doing. He was sending out this energy to the universe, to the planet. And the other method he used was something, another kind of projectors, but they were very small. They were about the size of a postage stamp. And he had about, maybe about 40 of them. And they were for, each one was for either a specific disease, like an abscess, or congestive heart failure, diabetes, mental attitudes. And what he would do, oxygen, is this little postage thing. It was a little piece of cardboard, and he would write the name on it of what it was for, oxygen. And he would put it on someone's forehead. And I don't know how it would stick there, but it sticks. And he just put it there, and it would stick there. And they would absorb the energy from this, and he would tell them that don't leave it on for more than 3 minutes because you'll get an overdose. And there's in the audio tapes of one of his classes, he's showing people how to use these things. And this woman is, he said he would diagnose people with the pendulum, and he would go around the group, and he'd say to this woman, Elena, you have trouble breathing. She said, that's correct. And he said, well, I need to give you oxygen. So he'd put the oxygen on there, and he'd sort of start talking to other people. And all of a sudden, the woman was hyperventilating. And he said, I'm sorry. He says, I left it on too long because you're getting too much oxygen. So these things were very, very powerful. But they're just pieces of cardboard. But he would imprint them with this thought form of, it was almost like a DNA of this healing energy, and he would use these on people. And to my knowledge, no one else has done anything like this.
No, that certainly sounds very unique to me. And as you said, your father really was a man well ahead of his time, wasn't he?
Yeah, and anybody who is usually pays a price for that. But I'm increasingly when I have these conversations about him and his work, I'm so proud of him, and I feel that when I do these lectures that it's really I was at a library the other day and I was talking and it went on for quite some time and people have a lot of questions. I said, do you mind? They said, do you mind staying? I said, no, because I feel this is my responsibility for my father, because he had a gift that people actually need to know about. And I get all these emails from people that your book has influenced me to really, I always thought maybe I had some healing abilities, and I really want to pursue it. I really want to know about these things, and I think the book is opening a lot of doors for people. And I'm very proud of my father that he's this influence now for people to really sort of stand up and take control of their energy and their own power.
Wonderful, yes. But when your father was in touch with people on the other side, could he actually call them up if he wanted to speak to someone specifically?
Yes, he would. Usually they would kind of let him know, like Arthur would show up, but if he had, for example, and in the tapes on the healings, he would call in this guy Chandrasen, his master physician, if someone had like a bad back or whatever. But it's interesting that people say, what is the most extraordinary thing he did? Well, you know, I think dissolving tumors is pretty amazing, or cerebral hemorrhages, he said healings are basically instantaneous. It's not that the healing takes 6 weeks like a medication. It's just simply, it's a switch of the energy. But one of the things he would do is, a lot of people seem to come to the house with one leg shorter than the other. And in fact, I was listening to a tape the other day, and it's on there. And there's a testimonial letter on the website, the walkingthroughwallsthebook.com, that there's a letter from a guy who came to my father with one leg shorter than the other. And there's no surgery in the world that would fix that. And he would basically lift up the guy's legs at the ankle, and you would see from my father's knuckles in his finger that there was like a 2-inch gap there. And what he would do at that point is call in Chandrasen and say, I need help fixing this guy's legs. And it would take about 3 minutes, and it was very quiet. My father would stand there, and it was almost imperceptible, but within like a couple minutes, all of a sudden his knuckles were matched up, and the guy's legs were even for the first time in his life. So, yes, he was able to call in, or if there was an emergency, he could call in different spirits to help him with the healing. And if you have time, there's one more story that when I told you that he had given a homeopathic remedy to a woman who then, called the FDA, and the FDA came in, and basically, with all these papers, there's a complaint about my father for dispensing medicine without a license. And the guy brought a Polaroid camera, and he said, I want to see this bottle of medicine. And he didn't know what homeopathic medicines, you know, were, because no one knew at the time. And so my father took it out, but he was terrified. He was really going to go to prison now for a long time. And what he did is he called in, and this again is on tape, but it's in the book. He called in one of his spirit guides and say, don't let them photograph the bottle, because I'm going to go to jail. And the guy took out the Polaroid, and he put the bottle on his briefcase, and he took out the Polaroid. This is the old-fashioned Polaroid where you would peel back the liner, and it was a little pink squeegee, and you would seal it that way, fix it. And the guy photographed it a couple times, and he's waiting for the picture to develop. And when he peels back the black paper, the briefcase is in focus, the bottle's in focus, but the label was completely blurred. It's like a cloud just blew over the label, and you couldn't see it. And the guy said, well, I must have shaken the camera. So my father says, okay, you know, take another picture, be my guest. And he took another picture, and the same thing happened. And so, yes, it's a long story again, but he was able to call in spirit guides.
That's wonderful, yeah. They're marvelous stories. Did he ever come to England?
He came to Scotland. He went to see Findhorn.
He
got married remarried in the 70s. I don't know the date offhand, but he did go to Findhorn, and that was like he didn't really travel. You know, what happened was he was born in Poland, and there was a lot of persecution at the time, and he got out basically alive, and he was so grateful to be in America that he sort of didn't want to go anywhere. And I was always trying to encourage him to travel. He did travel somewhat in the U.S., but he was not a traveler, and he also felt that it was irresponsible of him to get up and go somewhere because people needed him so badly. I had encouraged him to travel, but he didn't want to.
Yeah. But the only reason I asked that is that I suspected that had he come to England, he would well have found himself being invited to the College of Psychic Studies.
Oh, that would have been, he would have loved that. He was, and, you know, I think that you know, now I'm a wiser man. I was a kid at the time, and I could have helped him a lot. Now that what I know now, I could have helped him. But he was so hungry to basically have an audience and to teach people what he knew. He wanted to share this, and he would have loved that opportunity. And I found letters in his file of writing to, you know, to different organizations and universities saying, you know, please study me. But, you know, you look at the letter and you think, yeah, this guy's crazy. I'm not going to write back. Mm. So, you know, he was born too soon. I mean, today he'd be on Oprah and, you know, everything else.
Oh, yes, yes. Are you yourself in contact with your father now?
I am not on a steady basis, but things happen, and he does stuff. He arranges stuff. There's a great story in the book. I keep going back to these stories because they're easier for me to pull up in my mind.
Right.
But,
yes. Yeah.
When my father died on the anniversary of his death, I went to a psychic, and we were talking about my father. And it was also, there was a new release of a Richard Attenborough film. It was a biography of Charlie Chaplin.
Yes.
And my father had worked for Charlie Chaplin in the early 20s. He was a cameraman, and it's a long story. But anyway, my father was also a photographer, and I had seen many of his pictures, but he had always talked about this photograph that he had taken of Charlie Chaplin outside the studio with Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford. I was very proud of that photograph, but he had never shown it to me. I had never seen it, and at this point he had been gone for 10 years. And I'm watching the movie, and it's the anniversary of his passing, and I'm thinking, how come I never saw that photograph? I've looked through everything. And then I thought, well, maybe he lost it, maybe he made it, whatever, I don't know. The next day I called my mom, who had just moved into a new apartment, and they had been divorced for about, 16 years. And we were talking. I said, Mom, did you get this done? Did you get this done? She says, yes, I'm still unpacking. I said, where'd you put the sofa? You know, usual. And so I said, okay, I'll talk to you later. I start to hang up. She says, oh, I forgot to tell you something. She said, something weird happened. She says, I'm actually getting goosebumps. She said, I was unpacking my books, and I was putting my cookbooks. She used to get a lot of cookbooks, and I was putting them on the bookshelf. And she says, one of the books fell down, and when it opened, there was a tiny little picture in there, but I've never seen this before. I said, you know what, Mom? You and I bought a lot of cookbooks at these garage sales and thrift shops. I said, it's probably, you know, someone's picture. Just, you don't want that. Throw it out. And she said, well, on the back, there's this brown ink writing. It says, Charlie Mary Douglas. And I said, oh, my God. I said, Mom, that's the picture I've been looking for. I said, how do you have this? She said, I don't know. I have nothing of your father's. We got divorced 16 years ago. I don't have a thing of his.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is on the anniversary, the 10th anniversary of his death, and I thought, well, okay, Pop, I got it. You know, you're here.
Yes.
So it's stuff like, that's how I don't have actual communication with, I have more of that with my mom.
Right.
She comes in dreams and talks to me and very specifically. But with my father, it's more events. And one last thing, when I turn the book in to the publisher, I guess the book goes through a number of stages. It goes to the copy editor and the proofreader and the production manager and the art director. And this is a very large corporation. And my editor said to me, he said, you know, it's kind of funny. I do like 20 books a month. And I have my favorites of who I would like certain books, you know, oh, this book would be good with this art director. Or I'd like this copy editor to have this book. He says, but that's a corporate decision. I don't have any control over that. He said, I've been here, you know, 14 years, and your book is the first book that landed on the desk of everyone I wanted to see the book. And I said, you know, don't look at me. I have nothing to do with it. So, he's around.
Oh, yes, definitely. Now, something that fascinated me that you mentioned in the early part of the program, because I have a very strong and serious interest in ETs, you mentioned that your father was contacted by them. Have you any details of that?
No, it was more not like, it was more, it was more ethereal spirits than extraterrestrials. Oh. That was something he was fascinated by, but there was no real experience with it. But I will, let me give you this little link here, which is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Arthur Ford. As you know, Edgar Mitchell was one of the astronauts who went to the moon. And when Edgar came back, he got very interested in expanded consciousness, in psychic phenomena, and he founded the Institute for Noetic Sciences. Guess who was a good friend of Edgar Mitchell was Arthur Ford.
Hmm.
And so there are these very interesting connections out there. And recently, I think it was in the news, but it sort of didn't make the papers. It was on the Internet that Edgar Mitchell said that basically he and this is a guy, I think, you know, he's a physicist, he's a doctorate, he was in the military, he went to the moon, and he said, look, I've seen it. The government is clearly hiding all the data. They've been here. They are here. There's a lot of evidence. This is not some fabrication.
Right. Now, Philip, the program's gone so quickly, or almost gone. You're an excellent speaker, and it's been very fascinating to hear your story. In the couple of minutes or so that I've got left, tell us where people can buy your book. And perhaps you might also give a thought to tell us if there is any particular message you want to give out relating to the book. What is it trying to tell us?
Okay. Well, the book, both in England and the U.S., is certainly available on Amazon. It was largely available in Barnes & Noble and all the major bookstores, but they've sold out of them. And it's, you have to go into Barnes & Noble and actually order it, but the paperback is going to be coming out in maybe 3 weeks, so you can save a lot of money buying the paperback. But it is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, the Internet site. And, you know, the book, I'm hoping that people will realize that there's a lot more to this existence than going to work and going on vacation with your wife, and that we are these energetic, magnetic beings, and that life is such a miraculous opportunity to be here. And my father seemed to explore the outer reaches of what's possible. And I think that even though he was advanced, this is only the beginning of what we can do as these energetic spiritual beings. And I guess in a way, I mean, it's hard for all of us, and I know all of us are working very hard to be more like light beings and more spiritual, but if we can just stay on that purpose as much as possible and, you know, exhibit kindness and love toward one another, we can do a lot of things that way.
Yes, indeed. Well, your website address for anyone interested?
Yeah, it's the name of the book. It's www.walkingthroughwallsthebook.com. And I encourage people to go there because what I did was basically build a little bit of a museum to my father. He was, you know, an interior decorator, and you can see his interiors. You can see his healing tools. There are actual messages from you know, Arthur and various other physicians that he talked to. And there's also letters from people he healed. Some of, like, their name and address is blocked out because I had to do that. But you can see things and really learn, you know, have a visual education about him. So it's walkingthroughwallsthebook.com.
Brilliant. Well, you finished on the dot. Thank you very much, Philip. That really was terrific. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm sure my listeners have. So I'm going to take the last couple of minutes of my program to give out brief details of next week's guest, who is going to be Tricia Kelly, who's written a new non-fictional novel called Spirit Boy, and she refers to it as being spiritual psychology, and it's a new age manual for positive parenting. So I'll put a bit more detail on the website when I put the details in. So thank you for being with me today, and I hope you can be with me next week. God bless you all. Thank you.